Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes award-winning memoirist, critic, and best-selling author of The Lost, Daniel Mendelsohn. Mendelsohn's new book is An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and an Epic, a deeply moving tale of a father and son's transformative journey in reading and reliving Homer's epic masterpiece. Monday, October 16th at 7 p.m., more at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
The governor has these guys called the state troopers. And I swear to God, Dan, if the ICE officers violate the laws of Maryland and violate the rights of the citizens and guests of us here in the state of Maryland, I will have state troopers arrest the ICE officers. And God bless the confrontation that brings with Donald Trump.
That's the voice of tech guru Alec Ross, a Democratic candidate for governor of Maryland, vowing, if he's elected, to challenge Donald Trump's crackdown on immigrants. Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 305, for Thursday, the 5th day of October, 2017. That comment by Alec Ross promising to have state troopers arrest federal agents of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, if they trample on the rights of immigrants, is provocative but also problematic. It at least needs some perspective. Ross was here last week for his first candidate interview, and he had a lot of interesting things to say. As you'll hear, he brought up this matter of state troopers arresting ICE agents at the very end of our time together. And it took me by surprise. I had to check out the legality of what he promised. Can a governor order the state police to arrest federal agents as they carry out the Trump administration's stepped-up campaign to detain and deport immigrants in the country without permission? That's the question. Let me deal with this, at least in part, up front before we go to the full Alec Ross interview. Greg Shipley, spokesman for the state police, sent me a copy of the oath that state troopers take, and he added this. We do swear to obey the orders of the governor, but we also swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States, the laws of Maryland, and the rules and regulations of the Maryland State Police. That includes knowing we can only make a lawful arrest when there is a valid basis for that arrest, originating in a violation of state law. There must be legal grounds for an arrest, and not just the direction of a governor or anyone else to a trooper to lock someone up. Mark Graber, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, said, governors cannot issue arrest warrants. State officials cannot arrest federal officials carrying out federal duties. Others familiar with constitutional law said similar things. The governor and presumably the chief of police can order a trooper to obtain an arrest warrant. But whether the arrest warrant is given depends on whether there's probable cause for the arrest. I went back to Alec Ross for elaboration, clarification, and I'll read the statement he sent me last night after the interview. So let's get to that now. The interview runs about 35 minutes. Alec Ross is 45 years old, and he's packed a lot into his life, as you'll hear. He is a technology policy expert who worked for Barack Obama when he ran for president the first time, and for Hillary Clinton when she served as Secretary of State. While at State, Alec Ross was a special advisor for innovation, traveled to some 40 countries, and among his projects, he worked with the late ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, to fight the internet blackout imposed by Muammar Gaddafi during the uprising there. He was also what he calls a hacker for good, who helped Syrian rebels opposed to the Assad regime. Before all of that, Alec Ross was the co-founder of One Economy, a nonprofit that helped deliver high-speed internet and technology training to low-income people in Baltimore and other places. Ross lives here in Baltimore with his wife and three children. He is the author of Industries of the Future, a 2016 book on global technological innovation. He is seeking the Democratic nomination for governor in Maryland's June 2018 primary. So, Alec, it's nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Why are you running for governor?
I'm running for governor because I think that talent is everywhere. Opportunity is not, and that needs to change. And what I've been doing for, I'm 45 years old, what I've been doing since I was a teenager is taking talent and opportunity and putting them together. And the governor's office is a powerful place where you can do that.
You think there's a lot of talent in Maryland?
Oh,
a lot of talent in Baltimore?
Goodness gracious. Look, I'm unusual in that I grew up in coal country, but I was a Baltimore City public school teacher at Booker T. Washington Middle School. And I got to tell you, fast forward, I'm working in Obama's White House. I'm working for Hillary Clinton at the State Department. I'll tell you what. I am utterly convinced that the sixth graders I taught on McCullough Street at Booker T. Washington Middle School are made of have the same God-given talent as the people who sat across the table from me in the White House Situation Room. They just had wildly different opportunities. Talent is everywhere. Opportunity is not.
Let's go back to coal country. Tell us where that was. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the hills of southern West Virginia. And because of a woman named, who my friends nicknamed Becky the Barbarian, my mother, she said, look, you, your brother, and your sister, you're public school kids from the hills of West Virginia, but you will go to college. And, I hustled. I did get into college. And during college, I had really fancy jobs like working as a midnight janitor and working on a beer truck. And I moved to Baltimore.
Where'd you go to college?
Northwestern University.
Had anyone else gone to college before that?
They had. So, look, I didn't grow up in poverty. I grew up in sort of what you'd call sort of a solidly working class household. We didn't grow up in poverty. But, my mother, living around a lot of poverty, said, you're not gonna grow up and be a country bumpkin. You will go to college. You will become the best of whatever you can be.
What did she do?
She was a homemaker.
How about your dad?
He was a country lawyer. Country lawyer in Hurricane, West Virginia, which we pronounced Hurricane. And when you're a country lawyer in Hurricane, West Virginia, you sometimes get paid peaches and tomatoes.
When you went to Northwestern, what was your ambition there? What did you study?
I studied history. Even though I've worked in technology and entrepreneurship, I still sort of see the world through the eyes of a historian. I think that to understand the forces shaping the future, it really helps to understand the past. So I was a history major at Northwestern.
Any interest in the law?
No, not me. I think that I'm more of an entrepreneur. And I think that sort of the entrepreneurial mindset and the lawyerly mindset are a little different. So I never considered becoming a lawyer.
How'd you know you were an entrepreneur?
I think it's DNA. I don't know. I just always saw things not as they were, but as they should be. I'm always one of those guys who tried to imagine and invent the future. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I've always been sort of a builder. I like trying to be creative and trying to imagine what ought to be and then building something that'll take us there.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that about yourself in college?
No. I mean, look, I don't think I was that self-reflective in college. I'm sure that there were, people who weren't just intelligent but wise when they were in college. But I was a public school kid from coal country, suddenly went to a good college, and I loved it academically, and I did really well. But no, I don't think that I had sort of the kind of wisdom that would come from self-introspection to be able to say, well, this is who I am.
So what did you do with a bachelor's degree in history?
I joined Teach for America. And that's what brought me to Baltimore. When I was in Northwestern, I used to go down to the south side of Chicago, to the high-rise projects on the south side. And this is, in the time of the crack wars in the projects down there. And I used to tutor. And I loved tutoring. When I was in school, I loved the academics of it, but I wanted to get my hands dirty. I didn't want to sort of live a life in the ivory tower. So I joined Teach for America, and I was placed. I literally got a letter in 1994 that said, congratulations, you're going to be a teacher in Baltimore City, Maryland.
I think that was the first time we became aware of you in the 1990s, right?
That's right.
When you were there, The Sun did a series about your experiences.
Look, I looked like a baby. I was 22, 23 years old. Again, this was a rough time in Baltimore's history back in the early, mid-90s. I was teaching in a school that had a lot of problem with violence. And the Baltimore Sun did a year-long series on me. And the reporter, great reporter, a guy named Mike Bowler, told me he picked me because he thought I was going to get eaten alive. And it was going to be this sort of profile in how this idealistic, young, well-educated white guy got his butt whooped going into the West Baltimore middle schools. But you know what? I went well. It turned out I was a pretty good teacher. And I loved the community, and the community, you know, really embraced me. And this reporter, Mike Bowler from the Baltimore Sun, reported accurately. And so it ended up being a great series and highlighted the brilliance and beauty of my students. Hard lives, really hard lives. This is still back when HIV and AIDS were just slaying people. And so back then, AIDS was ravaging the community. Crack was ravaging the community. And so there was a lot of negative to report. But I think the beauty of the students came through and the brilliance of the students came through.
What did you take away from all that?
What I took away from that was that those kids are smart as heck. You know, I swear to God, Dan, you can go to any fancy old prep school, and I don't think those kids are quote-unquote smarter than the kids in West Baltimore. They just have got a lot more going for them. So I came out of that experience saying, you know what, these kids, from nearly the day they're born, have got a lot going against them. You know, this is where, you know, the kids are, you know, lead poisoning, fetal alcohol syndrome. You know, a lot of my kids I got, you know, who from literally the first days they were born, they had problems. But I'm telling you what, they had the same God-given ability. And from then till present day, nobody can persuade me otherwise. Nobody can tell me that the kids in inner city Baltimore don't have God-given talent.
One more question about that experience. Did you find that those problems that they brought to school, that they were born with, that they were coming from, made it impossible to teach?
No, not impossible. Made it really hard. I mean, my classroom, room 308, Booker T. Washington Middle School, I don't know if they number it the same way, but, you know, it was this teeny tiny little classroom. And, you know, one class had 38 students, one had 36 students. When I taught social studies, I taught 100 students, so three classes of, you know, 30-some students, but I only had one set of textbooks. So the only time the kids could get the textbooks, you couldn't take them home to do homework or read it. You only had it for like the 50 minutes that you were in my class. And the textbooks were so old that if you turn to the last page, I'll never forget the last page, it sort of said, "New Afro-American Hero, Arthur Ashe." So I had one set of
a tennis player of the 1960s and 70s.
That's right. Who at that point, I think, had died of AIDS. And so I literally had, I had a single set of textbooks from the 1970s to teach 100 middle schoolers in the 1990s in Baltimore.
After that, you could have stayed with teaching, but you didn't.
I didn't. I was like, I'm getting these 12, 13, 14-year-olds in a certain state. Why are they, you know, and I close the door and I do what I could for 9 months. But what, you know, what are the broader systems and circumstances that are making life so difficult for them? Around this time, I fell in love with the teacher across the hall. I was teaching social studies and language arts. She was teaching math. My wife still teaches in Baltimore City Public Schools. And, you know, Felicity chose to say, you know what, I'm going to hunker down every year with, you know, 30 kids in a classroom. I said, I want to focus on the systems. So what I then did immediately after teaching is, this was back in 1996, I did a voter registration project for communities of color. So I spent 7 months helping African-American and Latinos register to vote. And then went from that, I spent 3 years working at a not-for-profit founded by Jim Rouse. It was then called the Enterprise Foundation. It's now called Enterprise Community Partners. So I spent 3 years doing affordable housing and community development work. And from that, I was witnessing this technology-led transformation of the economy. I was like, you know what? The jobs in the ports, the factories, the mines, and the mills, they're going away. And kids who grew up in communities like mine in coal country, kids like those who I taught at Booker T. Washington, like if the good old union wage jobs at the port, factory, mine, and mill is going away, what can we do? So I started a nonprofit in 2000, the purpose of which was to bridge the digital divide. It was to get technology into the homes and communities of people of low incomes and to then give them really serious technology training so that they could then go get good jobs.
What was that like for you, starting up a nonprofit like that?
You know, it's one of those things. I was 28 years old, and if I knew then what I knew now, I would have never started it because I would have recognized all the reasons why it wouldn't have worked. But because I was 28, I didn't know I was supposed to fail, so I didn't. We went from being a couple knuckleheads in a basement saying, hey, technology can be this tool of empowerment for poor people, to, my goodness, it sort of shot to the moon. And we came sort of a global nonprofit and helped, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people. But being an entrepreneur
is tough.
Well, you were
on the edge of something at the time. So why do you look back on it and say you never would have done it? It seemed to me you were out ahead of something there.
Oh, we were. No, great timing. But in retrospect, we didn't have any money. We didn't have any sort of fancy uncles to pay for it.
A mere detail.
A mere detail. Yeah, we were a couple of guys in a basement with an idea. You know, oh, we're going to fight poverty by, you know, teaching low-income African-American and Latino and working-class white kids how to, you know, get good skills. No money. But we scrapped. And what I would do, I would send cold call emails. I would make up the email address for, like, Bill Gates. I'm like, all right, it's either bill.gates@microsoft.com, bgates@microsoft.com, william_gates, yeah. And I would send it to like 20 email addresses.
Did you ever get a response?
I did. And so 19 would bounce back, but one would go through, and in that email, I would just, it would be this real crisp email where I'd say, you know, Mr. Gates, I'm building a nonprofit to use technology to fight poverty. You know, I'm a former Teach for America teacher. Will you give me 15 minutes? And then you'd get this reply that would say, Alec, you know, copying my assistant to find the 15 minutes. And so we ended up building our nonprofit with support from like Google and the Gates Foundation and the Ford Foundation because we hustled. We hustled. And we had a model that really worked because these young people, when you did train them using technology, it worked. And you know what? We helped a whole heck of a lot of people get jobs.
And where did that nonprofit, which was called
One Economy.
Where did that take you? To other cities besides Baltimore?
Yeah, no. So it was headquartered in D.C. So there were four founders, two from D.C., one from Columbia, and me from Baltimore. We headquartered it in D.C., and it was a national nonprofit. So we ended up working all over the country. We ended up becoming a good-sized organization.
What's the legacy of One Economy?
The legacy from One Economy is bridging the digital divide in a lot of urban and rural communities in America. Look, no broadband, no economy. If you don't have a high-speed internet access at home, you can't apply for a job at McDonald's. You know, the day of the good old-fashioned resume on thick resume paper, that's gone. You know, you don't go to job boards anymore to find the job openings. You find them all online. And, you know, even the jobs that you used to think of, you know, being done with men with big, strong shoulders down at the port, now those jobs at the port are people sitting behind computer screens operating really powerful mechanized robotics. So, you know, we didn't solve poverty, but we helped a huge number of people of low incomes enter the economic mainstream because we helped them get technology skills. And it was from this that Barack Obama, you know, we worked on the south side of Chicago in the Section 8 housing, which was in his old state Senate district. I got to know Barack Obama when he was a state senator because he took a real interest in the work we were doing in Chicago. And I was just like, this guy's really smart. And so I then built a relationship with state Senator Obama, who became Senator Obama. And when he ran for president, that's when I was recruited to run technology policy for that first presidential campaign of his.
What was the scope of your work in that campaign in 2008? Because that campaign was heralded for its tech savvy.
Yeah. So my focus was on policy. So it really had two roles. First of all, being the liaison to the technology world, sort of Silicon Valley, for the Obama campaign. So we did a great job innovating on that campaign. And, you know, I wasn't in charge of like the email or anything like that. But if we needed help from Apple to build an app or Google to help do search optimization, you know, I built those partnerships. And then the second thing, which ended up being of even greater consequence because of the economic collapse, was it was my job to work with a big team, ended up being over 150 advisors, to develop policies that were all rooted in technology and science. And what would those technology and science policies be in an Obama administration? And so after the election, when I joined the presidential transition team and when we did the stimulus bill, the Economic Recovery Act, about, you know, $30, $40 billion that went into that huge recovery act ended up being the policies that we developed. So we have LTE on our cell phones, these 4G wireless networks, in part because of broadband programs we put in place during the campaign, which then became law right when Obama became president.
Was that when you felt like you really had your hands on the future?
I did. You know, look, working for Barack Obama is something when I hope to be 80 years old, have my grandkids on my knee, and I'll be telling stories about those years working for President Obama.
Very exciting time, not only because of him, but because of the technology.
Because of the technology, and also bluntly because of the economic collapse. Because there was a sense of real peril. Is the economy collapsing? And for us, the question was, can technology be a part of the solution for restoring the economy? And it was in part. But there was a lot of drama back then. And we had a candidate who I believed in and a president who I think ended up doing a great job.
You worked for Hillary Clinton.
That's right. So the work I did on the Obama campaign, let's be honest, let's be a little undiplomatic here, it sort of came at her expense. And when she was made Secretary of State, you know, I was summoned to see her. And I was like, why does Hillary Clinton want to see me? Does she want to, like, yell at me? And I sat down with her, and she said, you know, look, I thought I was going to be president. I have a lot of people who are going to fill up the sort of appointed jobs in senior government. Now I have to get them all into one place, the State Department. She goes, but I need to make one exception. She goes, I want you to come work for me. Make up your own title, which is why I got a cool title like Senior Advisor for Innovation.
What did she want you to do?
You know what she wanted? She wanted me to come in and be somebody where when the rest of the organization was stuck in the mud, I would bring a new mindset. I'll give you a concrete example. So like, here's just one example from 2009 when she first became Secretary of State. I think she had been in one too many meetings about how many billions of dollars we were spending to fight the narcotics cartels in northern Mexico. If you remember, like 7, 8, 9 years ago, drug violence in Mexico, it was crazy. People were getting their heads cut off. People were finding like mountains of dead bodies. And so Secretary Clinton said, Alec, I want you to go down to Ciudad Juarez, and you don't come back, right?
You went to Ciudad Juarez?
Oh, I spent a lot of time down in Ciudad Juarez.
I mean,
Juarez.
They were hanging bodies from highway overpasses.
So when you are told by the Secretary of State to go to Ciudad Juarez and not come back until you have a solution, this is what is known as an incentive. So I went down there with the team, and the short version of it is we came up with an idea. It's still in place down there. It's called an denuncia anonima, where basically it's a text messaging program where every abuela, every little old grandmother with a cell phone can send a text message that becomes anonymized and encrypted. It goes to a secure federal facility that only very heavily vetted federal police get. And it's where the proverbial abuela can say, hey, there are a couple cartel members, you know, drinking beer at this cafe, or hey, there's a drug house on my street. And this helped take down the leadership of two cartels. And so technology enabled this, an anonymized encrypted text messaging program. And so my job was sort of to be the hacker for good. And we did this all over the world. You know, it was my job to work with the now dead U.S. ambassador to Libya. Before he was ambassador, when the revolution was taking place in Libya, Chris and I were the two whose job it was to restore communications in rebel-held territory after the Gaddafis had shut it down. So it was my job, basically. I wasn't the IT guy. I wasn't, like, in charge of Hillary's email or anything like that. I was in charge of figuring out how to maximize the promise and minimize the peril of technology in American diplomacy and foreign policy.
How did you feel at the end of that service?
We did a lot of good. To be honest with you, a lot of the crazy ideas that I had going into the job proved true. I mean, I'll never forget talking about things like a leaderless revolution and a lot of the sort of, you know, white shirt, red tie, pinstripe diplomat sort of sneered at me, like, oh, the little internet guy thinks that, you know, there can be a network-enabled revolution. Well, guess what? Look what happened. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, right time, right place. I built a great team, came out of it feeling very proud of my service and very proud of having been able to work with some tremendous public servants in the Obama administration.
And then there was a period where Hillary Clinton got grilled over Benghazi. She was no longer Secretary of State. She announced that she was running for president.
And the wheels came off.
Yeah. Did you see Trump coming?
I didn't see Trump as an individual coming. I saw what he represented coming, which is a sort of populist, nativist, racist, angry uprising. So Trump,
where did you see that? Where was the evidence of that? Did you read Hillbilly Elegy or you back to West Virginia?
Yeah. So so this is before Hillbilly Elegy. I mean, this is, you know, spending time in working class communities. You know, look, the very simple fact of the matter is that we're now going on 40 years of economic stagnation for the working class. You know, we're at 30 years where corporate profits and the earnings of the top 1% shoot into the moon. But the working class has stagnated. And it's not just that it's sort of stagnated. It's like, oh, guess what? You're only going to get a 1% increase in pay. But, oh, by the way, your healthcare is going to now cost $200 a month. And this has gone on long enough that people are really pissed off. And so what I think Trump is a byproduct of decades of economic stagnation. And then you've got things like social media that show how well other people are doing. And we've become a more unequal society.
Where was the buy-in for a millionaire, I guess a billionaire? Trump says he's a billionaire. I don't understand that.
Yeah,
there's the disconnect for me is why this wasn't associated more with the Democratic Party. Maybe people didn't like Hillary Clinton, but certainly the legacy of the Democratic Party is much richer for working class people than the Republican Party is.
I'm in violent agreement with you. I'm in total agreement with you. What I think Donald Trump did is he sort of brilliantly manipulated the information environment. I mean, it's to his credit. I mean, people think that Donald Trump is stupid. He's not stupid. I think he's a horrible person. I think there are 7.5 billion people on planet Earth. I might very well be the person who dislikes Donald Trump the most. I detest him. But I don't think he's stupid. I think he's a master propagandist. And the fact that we got a guy who was born on third base, inherited $200 million from his daddy, from New York City, who somehow convinces people in Dundalk, somehow convinces people in Garrett County, somehow convinces people in Carroll County that he's one of them, it's masterful propaganda.
Speaking of those people in Dundalk, I wrote a column in the summer of 2016 about personal responsibility. In this context, the steel mills have closed, the assembly line is gone, manufacturing is gone, it's been gone for a long time. What kind of personal responsibility did you, the Trump voter here in formerly Democratic Baltimore County, now Republican Baltimore County, take for your future, for your kids' future, for your grandchildren's future? Did you encourage them to go to college? The college graduation rate in the district that we're speaking of, in Dundalk actually specifically, is where the Baltimore area was in 1970. The metro area has actually progressed quite a bit in terms of those with college education, college degrees. But that's a question I raise. I put it on people themselves, not just the system, not just government. Did people smarten up to this?
Well, I think some have, but too many haven't.
Yeah.
This
goes back to your issue about opportunity and talent.
And call me old-fashioned, but, you know, going back to my mother, Becky the Barbarian, boy, let me tell you, she was all about personal responsibility. And I am, again, maybe I'm old-fashioned, I do believe in personal and family responsibility. It's just not my personality to sort of finger wag at a community and say, oh, you guys didn't pivot. Like, do I think they should have? Sure. But, you know, part of why I'm now running for governor is because I do think I can recognize some opportunities to help communities like Dundalk pivot, help people in struggling working class communities pivot. So sure, do I think ultimately the strongest unit for changing anything is the family? Heck yeah. But absent that, there are things that the state can do. And that's kind of what I'm fired up to do now.
Give us an idea. What do you mean?
So I'll give you an idea. We were talking about college, and I do think that going to college is important, but the God's honest truth, Dan, is that not everybody's going to college. And one area where I do fault Democrats, and I do think, look, I'm a Democrat, but I think we need to hold ourselves to account where we've come up short or where we've lost the plot. One area where I do think Democrats have done a lousy job recently is if you listen to our leaders, and if you both rhetorically as well as look at the policies— In education, it goes like this. You go to college, you're a winner. You don't go to college, you're a loser. And so I think that some of the disconnection between working class Americans and the Democratic Party is the Democratic Party sort of become very elitist in a manner of speaking. And we talk to you like losers, and we treat you like losers, and we give you no programs if you're not going to college. So as a very practical matter, so, I mean, let's get concrete about this. The state of Maryland has a $7.7 billion post-secondary education budget. I would like to pivot more of that towards apprenticeships and technical education for people who aren't going to college. We have a weird economy in Maryland in that we have a lot of knowledge workers, sort of people who put on a white shirt and a red tie for work. We've got the NSA, the NIH, Johns Hopkins, all these software companies. We got a lot of that. But then we also have this very heavy concentration of workers, of people who work at and around minimum wage. But where we're thin is in the middle. We are a state. Here we've got underemployed people, and here we've got people who work at and around minimum wage, but we have too few electricians. We have too few plumbers. We have too few people who know how to string the fiber into a new building being built.
Garage mechanics.
And the thing is, like, you can't go online for 30 minutes and learn how to become an electrician. Nope. You need a good old-fashioned, serious apprenticeship. And so as governor, one of the big areas where I would focus and where I would focus specifically for these communities that we've been talking about, Dan, is technical education and apprenticeships for people who aren't going to college. We can't just be sort of elitist.
Community colleges play a part in this, right? President Obama, you said, you know, the Democrats take this view as if you don't go to college, you're a loser. Actually, President Obama was advocating free community college.
Right, but here's the thing, is community college needs to be more than just a transition to a four-year degree.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's the place where you could do what you want to do.
It's the platform for doing it. Yeah. It's exactly right. And we've got some good community colleges in Maryland, Montgomery Community College, Anne Arundel Community College. So there are places that have the capacity to do more of this, especially if they get the state resources to do it.
Well, speaking of that, how do you think the state has done in terms of supporting basic public education?
Terrible. I mean, Maryland it's bananas. We are 24 jurisdictions, and we have some of the best public education in the United States of America, and we've got some of the worst public education in the United States of America. We are a highly unequal state in terms of public education. When I campaign around the state, sometimes I'll go into Howard County or Montgomery County, and I will go into schools and classrooms that they're gorgeous, and the teachers have master's degrees, and the class sizes are in the mid-20s, and there are these spectacular supplemental resources, and the kids are taking foreign languages and AP classes, and they've got these beautiful computer labs and science labs. This is what it should be. Then I go into public schools in Prince George's County or in eastern Baltimore County or in Baltimore City. And what do I see? I see upwards of 40 kids in a classroom. I see a single stack of textbooks. I see a computer lab with computers that don't have an internet connection. I see a science lab with, you know, beakers and nothing else. Those kids are screwed. And so I think there's an enormous amount of inequity in education in Maryland. And I think it's unfair.
How come we haven't fixed that after all these years?
We've never had an education.
You know, some people listening to this will say, you know, we've been throwing all this money at education, public education. We still have these problems, these inequities.
We haven't had an education governor. We haven't had a governor who has said, education is my number one issue. And that is what I am proposing to be. You know, education doesn't pay off in the short term. Doesn't pay off in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. But my attitude is you pay now or you pay later. Educate or incarcerate. Educate or pay for the human services that's going to go into folks. Look, the kind of education I see in Howard County and in lots of Montgomery County and in a few other parts of the state, my attitude is how can we enable the rise of the rest? How can we, you know, when people say, oh, Baltimore City's so beleaguered, these young kids don't have the skills to get good jobs. It all starts with having educations that aren't good enough. And so, look, I believe in over-investing in education. I believe in putting a real thumb on the scale to say, you know what, we're going to try to accelerate the well-being of these young people and do so through its schools.
Just the other day, I received a letter from a reader off of a column I had written about an encounter with a mechanic who fixed my car on a holiday weekend. I was very pleased at this. And I made the point that immigrants are important in terms of the workforce, in terms of productivity and growth. Economists will tell you there's a lot of baby boomers retiring. There are not enough people in our workforce who have skills and need to be trained. There just aren't enough people. So immigration is kind of important to this. And the woman who wrote to me took exception to that. But I tried to explain to her the need for this, the need for immigrants, just to keep the economy growing. And I like the idea of technical training, because we are way behind there. All these industries that you mentioned and the ones that I mentioned all complain that they don't have enough skilled workers. So what about immigration? And specifically, I wanted to ask you about the president's decision on DACA, on the Dreamers. How do you feel about what's happened there?
I think it's disgusting. Look, 40% of the Fortune 500 were founded by immigrants or the children of immigrants. Immigrants are an overwhelming economic good for the United States of America. You take away our immigrants, you got no Google. Who's Sergey Brin, the son of a Russian immigrant? You've got no YouTube, started by a Korean immigrant. You've got no Intel, started by a son of a Hungarian immigrant. Immigration is sort of the secret sauce of the United States' innovation. People travel from around the world to come work here. We are an entrepreneurial country. This goes back to the pioneers. You know, the pioneers, hey, we're gonna travel west and not know where we're gonna land, but we're gonna find a piece of land and we're gonna farm it. You know what that is? That's entrepreneurship. It is American. And so when you cut that off, you're cutting off that which makes us most special.
Trump would argue that we're not cutting off immigrants, we're cutting off illegal immigrants.
You know, look, Donald Trump, he is such an idiot. I mean, I really detest this guy. It's so easy when you're born on third base and when your daddy gives you $200 million when you turn 21. Look, I don't know that my family, I don't know what was legal or illegal when we came through Ellis Island from, you know, Ukraine, Poland, and Italy. I mean, this is all a new phenomenon. This legal, illegal thing. Give me a break. What I do believe is that the people who cross oceans to come to the United States of America because they believe in the American dream, they are what make the American dream real. They reanimate the American dream. They keep it current. They keep it alive. They give America its continual energy. And I also believe in the diversity that they bring. I think that part of what makes America special is its diversity. You know, I think that a lot of the sort of cranky white nationalism that comes out of Trump and others is, I don't think that they like the multiculturalism that comes with diversity, with people coming from Mexico. I don't think they like seeing street signs that are in Spanish and what have you. And you know what? My attitude is it actually makes this country better. It makes it more interesting. It makes us more vibrant. So I have a really unnuanced view on this.
And in the case of the Dreamers, those kids, I call them kids.
Come on. They're
young adults now. They've been here for so long. you know, we've invested in them, right?
Look,
they got public education in the United States.
I mean, what's the stat, Dan? Something like 90% of them are in school or in jobs. I mean, I'm sorry, three-year-olds are not hopping fences. You know, young people who are coming to this country, getting educations. I mean, I think Apple said that if the Dreamers kicked out, like, it's hundreds of their employees. These are people who give our country vitality.
There isn't much a governor can do about that, though. I guess you could ask your attorney general to sue the president somehow.
So that's
legal
one thing.
Action.
Here's another thing. And look, this is edgy, and I don't really care. I find real fault with some of the abuses being taken by the Immigration Customs Enforcement officers, these ICE officers. And I think they are rolling around East Baltimore, and they are rolling around Silver Spring. They are entering premises. They are entering premises without sort of due process on warrants. I'll tell you what. I will order. And these guys with their big, strong shoulders and their Oakley glasses, intimidating people in the state of Maryland. The governor has these guys called the state troopers. And I swear to God, Dan, if the ICE officers violate the laws of Maryland and violate the rights of the citizens and guests of us here in the state of Maryland, I will have state troopers arrest the ICE officers. And God bless the confrontation that brings with Donald Trump.
Thank you, Alec. Let's pick this up another day.
Thank you, Dan. Always great to be here.
I followed up with Ross on this matter of the governor ordering state police to arrest federal agents, and he issued this statement. As governor, I'd implement a policy to have the state troopers protect the rights of all Marylanders. With regards to ICE agents, I'd work with the state troopers to help prevent ICE from overstepping the limits of their warrants. In the event that ICE agents violate the constitutional rights of Marylanders, the state troopers would have standing orders from me to step in to protect Marylanders, including intervening to confront ICE agents as necessary. Again, this is provocative, but I think problematic, a position that probably needs more rigorous legal vetting. And I'll leave it there for now. Alec Ross will be invited back for another interview later this year or early next year. We're trying to bring you interviews with all the candidates. The candidates, and you know who you are, need to get in touch if they want to be on the show. Next week, we'll hear from another Democratic candidate for governor, Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker. More information about Alec Ross can be found in the notes with this podcast. We have interviews available with other Democratic candidates, Ben Jealous and Jim Shea. Tomorrow on the show, Blade Runner 2049, a good book recommendation, and what's up with Baltimore City's water bills. That's our show for now. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, this is Dan Rodrigues here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodrigues is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.